say where they are. That was the whole point of this, not to label around it, but in the meantime, that's kind of what we're left with.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. You can find their work on this and other issues online at foodandwaterwatch.org. Patty Lavera, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
It's 5:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition. Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is Round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in the following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Round 2. Sunday, August 28th at D Block, Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, Bread and Roses is taking a break. Up next, Rising Up with Sonali, produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. The U.S. Department of Justice has issued a damning report on the Baltimore Police Department, pointing out deep-rooted and systemic violations of the civil rights of African Americans, women, and transgender residents. The show discusses this with their correspondent, Jody Armour. Also, a 14-year-old boy has been killed by Los Angeles police in the historically Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights. The show speaks with Saul Marquez, an activist and resident of Boyle Heights. Plus, well-known British journalist and academic Hilary Wainwright joins Sonali to discuss her essay in the anthology Europe in Revolt called The Making of Jeremy Corbyn. From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The U.S. Department of Justice has issued a damning report on the Baltimore Police Department, pointing out deep-rooted and systemic violations of the civil rights of African Americans, women, and transgender residents. We'll turn to our correspondent Jody Armour for more. And a 14-year-old boy has been killed by Los Angeles police in the historically Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights. We'll speak with Saul Marquez, an activist and resident of Boyle Heights. Plus, well-known British journalist and academic Hilary Wainwright joins us to discuss her essay in the anthology Europe
in revolt called The Making of Jeremy Corbyn. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The U.S. Department of Justice recently released a damning report on the Baltimore Police Department in Maryland a year after riots rocked the city over Freddie Gray's police custody death. The report singles out how BPD officers routinely and egregiously violated the constitutional rights of African Americans, stopping black men in particular hundreds of times with few, if any, charges. Racist epithets were commonly used to refer to black residents, revealing widespread problems of racism among officers. The DOJ report additionally found gender bias against sexual assault victims and disproportionate targeting of transgender Baltimore residents. The problems are so systemic and deep-rooted that many community members and groups are calling for police officers who specifically violated policies to be publicly named and fired, and for the Baltimore Police Department to be overhauled from top to bottom. My guest is Jody Armour, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. He's the author of the book Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. He's a Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Society's Institute Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture, and he's the Race and Criminal Justice correspondent for this program. Welcome to Rising Up, Jody.
Good to be back with you, Sonali.
So first, what a horrific report detailing such top-to-bottom problems. If I didn't know that this report was written and investigated by the Department of Justice, I might imagine, you know, an independent watchdog organization looking at this police department. But this should not be surprising either to us as Americans, and certainly I can imagine it's not surprising at all to Baltimore's black residents, right?
Well, that's the key. This document is an important document for defining what the true narrative is out here between the community citizens and the police in general, black community members and the police in particular. We, for a long time, Sonali, had two different social realities going on in people's heads. You've had a community of black folks saying there's discrimination, there's profiling, there's brutality going on out here on a mass scale, and you aren't acknowledging it. And a lot of white Americans saying they don't see police community interactions as that fraught, as that troublesome necessarily. And you can watch different TV stations and listen to different radio programs, and it's like people are living in their own echo chambers and believing their own rhetoric and not checking it against external reality, empirical reality. Well, now we have a DOJ report that gives empirical support to the social reality that black folk have been describing, and a lot of non-black folk have been lowballing or discounting or rejecting. And it's a ringing vindication, really, of the rage that was in the streets of Baltimore protesting and doing in every way they possibly could, politically expressing their frustration and anger. And this report really, like I said again, vindicates them in spades.
Now, one might imagine that this report might not have even come about had there not been the riots last year. The DOJ also looked at Ferguson's police department because of the uprising there over Mike Brown's death. Do you feel that in many ways the DOJ is sending a message to communities around the country that we're going to ignore you and ignore the complaints that you make about your police departments until you make it impossible for us to do so?
That seems to be the formula, doesn't it? And it's it's a sad commentary on our democracy, but it is the way it is, right? That a lot of times it isn't until there's an uprising or what some people will characterize as a riot, civil unrest, let's say, if we want to be neutral. I view them as uprisings myself because I see them as expressions of righteous anger that's rooted in a social reality of oppression. So I view them as uprisings, but those who see them as illegitimate are going to call them riots, and we'll take a more neutral term for now, civil uprisings. These are going to continue to happen as long as there's this moral crisis, this crisis in moral legitimacy. And it seems, as you're pointing out, that as Black Lives Matter said, unless you disrupt and force, impose uncomfortable conversations on the powers that be, they will ignore you. And we shouldn't be there. So now it seems that city after city, DOJ keeps coming back with the same reports. It isn't a few bad apples. We have systemic problem. One thing this DOJ report, as the others put to rest, is the canard of the few bad apples. Oh, just a few bad apples. No, it's systemic, is what the DOJ report is saying very clearly. And why do we have to keep on requiring buildings to burn, black people's heads to get hit by sticks and tasers before we'll have some kind of DOJ response like this? That is the question.
And of course, having a report like this doesn't necessarily guarantee reform either. Now, let's talk about how you can trace back the BPD's problems. This perhaps is also applicable to police departments around the country. The DOJ report points out that the 1990s era of tough on crime policing is where a lot of these problems, deep-rooted problems, began, the so-called zero-tolerance enforcement. And even that language, zero-tolerance, such an unforgiving term, but is it important to understand the roots of this, that, rather than just pointing out the statistics, that it was these overzealous desires to over-police communities that predictably led us to where we are today?
Yeah, absolutely critical, Sonali, for us not to reproduce the mistakes of the past, to understand the source of those mistakes. And their source was this mentality that we have to be tough on crime. We have to become a tough on crime country. And part of getting tough on crime is allowing police a lot of discretion when it comes to things like broken windows policing or zero tolerance policing, which is basically the philosophy that from tiny acorns, mighty oak trees grow. If you don't nip things in the bud and really seize on little quality of life infractions like selling loose cigarettes on the sidewalk, it will escalate into more disorder and greater crime. That was the theory anyway. That theory has yet to be proven to be true, by the way, although it is an article of faith in a lot of law enforcement circles. So yes, the key insight that is coming out of more and more of these DOJ reports and discussions is that we have to change the way we think about crime and punishment and mass incarceration. Willie Horton cost the Democrats the 88 election between Dukakis and Bush Sr., the black recidivist. Trope was born. Reagan brought in the black welfare queen trope. You put all of that together, and we, for 30 plus years, thought of wrongdoers, especially black wrongdoers, as so much toxic human waste to be dumped somewhere. And so changing that mentality is the key, is what we're getting out.
Now, let's talk about some of the specifics from this report. Just horrific statistics. BPD officers recorded over 300,000 pedestrian stops from January 2010 to May 2005. This is the period over which the investigation focused on. And the DOJ report even admits that the real number might be much higher because they don't record every stops. Predominantly in African-American neighborhoods. And in all of these stops, only a tiny percentage actually resulted in actual charges. There were 7 African-American men during this 5-year period, that were stopped more than 30 times, and hundreds of men stopped on at least 10 separate occasions each of them. I mean, what is that like? I can't even imagine or fathom the trauma that comes from being continuously targeted by police as if you're a criminal.
Yeah, here's what it's like, and I'll point out that, by the way, this stop and frisk approach has not proven to be effective. The New York Daily News, I think it was, came out with a recent op-ed saying we were wrong. We thought that we needed stop and frisk. We thought that the judge that said it was unconstitutional was going to increase crime and there was going to be bloodshed in the street. And they're saying in a couple of days ago editorial, we were wrong. Actually, crime has declined. At the same time, their zero tolerance stop and frisk policies have been reduced. So, Sonali, I can just give you one quick response to what the experience must be like. I run into it repeatedly as a law school professor. I'm downtown at JW Marriott visiting a friend from A Better Chance, which is a program we both came from, targets inner city kids and gives them a chance to go to college by sending them to better schools and boarding schools. Lino Garcia, now the managing, general manager of ESPN Deportes, and I met at JW Marriott. We parted. I waited for my ride, had guards approach me and say, are you here to see someone? I said, yes, but why aren't you asking anyone else in the lobby? They said, because we've been having a problem with transients, sir. I was dressed like in a jacket, in a sports jacket, slacks, hard shoes. All I didn't have was a tie, but otherwise I had a professional suit. I said, so you're saying I look like a transient, a homeless person? He said, don't take it personally, sir. He walked back to the other two guards. He was a black one. They sent the black one over. He huddled with the other two white guards. I called a friend from Latham & Watkins and said, if they come back, I want you to hear this. He came back. He said, sir, what's the name of the guest you came here to see? I know as a law prof that if I don't give them a name that they can find in their database, I've assumed the ejectable status of a trespasser, and they were getting ready to lay hands on me and throw me out of the lobby of JW Marriott as a homeless person. And I had to swallow that indignity, Sonali, and give him that name and vindicate his perception of me or wind up in a paddy wagon. And black folk have to swallow those kind of dignities on a daily basis, and that's what this report is bringing out.
Oh, Jody, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And you know, I think this report does indicate that these and should be an indication that wherever the DOJ looks, it will find such systemic racism in its police departments, particularly in big cities. It's just a matter of taking the time and energy to look. So let's talk about the pervasive racism within the BPD, as pointed out by the DOJ report, simply in the language that the officers use among one another and to the people that they are targeting. The N-word, continuously and often used, racist epithets used, and this is, you know, pointed out by the Justice Department. Again, we shouldn't be surprised, should we?
Yeah, for 30 plus years, Sonali, we've otherized criminals. That is, we've, if you will, since they use the word, they use the language, we should too. They niggerize criminals or blacks they think might be involved in criminal activities. And it's been part of our popular culture, not just police culture. Chris Rock launched his comedic career walking back and forth in front of a black audience and saying, I love black people, but I hate niggers. Mm. And one of his core definitions of a so-called nigger was a black person who does a crime. So what he was saying was, I love law-abiding blacks, but I hate black criminals. Bill Cosby was saying that kind of stuff in his pound cake speech while he was hypocritically slipping Mickey's in women's drinks and abusing them. So you, for a long time, had in this country a kind of politics of respectability driven distinction between good Negroes and bad Negroes, black people and niggas, and as a culture, we've allowed ourselves to otherize black criminals who, by the way, are disproportionately poor. The black crime rates between middle class blacks, rather than crime rates between middle class blacks and middle class whites, are about the same. So most, when you're talking about N-words, you're mainly talking about truly disadvantaged blacks. We have treated these truly disadvantaged blacks as N-words for a long time, and now it's coming home to roost in our law enforcement policy.
The gender bias against sexual assault victims was also a rampant problem in the Baltimore Police Department, as the DOJ report points out. And there is such a horrific, such horrific descriptions of the treatments of victims, you know, people who are already victims one time around, only to essentially become victimized a second time around by the Baltimore Police Department. Doesn't the kind of behavior outlined in the report discourage the reporting of actual crime, something that, you know, is the whole point of the police?
Yeah, we don't take sexual assault seriously in this society and in this culture. And it should sadden but not surprise us that since we don't take it seriously as a society, our law enforcement agencies don't take it seriously either. And we have to change those attitudes in a proactive way. We even have problems with those attitudes coming into the jury box. When you have ordinary jurors bringing their, you know, kind of slut-shaming mentalities into the jury box and making assessments of sexual assault cases, date rape cases, et cetera, you have so many prejudices and stereotypes that are misogynistic and cut against victims of sexual abuse. And we really have to do more, one, to train on, you know, what is involved in these sexual assault cases and make them more understanding of what's going on. Number two, bringing more women officers onto the force.
Right. Vanita Gupta, the head of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, who was the one who actually held the press conference on the DOJ report, said that some women won't ever report a rape in Baltimore again. The police routinely failed to gather evidence and belittled women who reported sexual assault, and also in particular mistreated sex workers, which is also in some ways related to its treatment of transgender residents of Baltimore, trans women routinely harassed, accused of prostitution simply for standing at a bus stop. These should also, I think, and it's important, I think, that the DOJ pointed this out at a time when we have increasing attacks against transgender Americans in general, right?
Oh, yeah. What we found in the empirical research is that a lot of legal interventions didn't make much difference in increasing the conviction rate for accused rapists. They got rid of the force requirement in some jurisdictions and did other things with firming up what it means to consent and make affirmative expressions, but not a lot of increase in convictions until they did one thing, Sonali. They started implementing more rape shield laws. The rape shield laws, by keeping a woman's sexual history, a victim's sexual history, out of the trial, keeps the jury from having its judgment clouded by all kinds of stereotypes and prejudices it has. And what jurors tend to do, consciously or unconsciously, is vindicate the sexual autonomy interests of so-called good women, but not those of so-called bad women or ones they view as marginalized. And so, yeah, it is. We have a society-wide problem with victims from socially marginalized groups, whether they be transgender folk, whether they be poor women, whether they be women who don't fit certain stereotypes about what is an appropriate amount of sexual activity to engage in, slut-shaming kind of cultural problems that we have. And until we deal with that societally, we're going to keep having these problems. But one place to start is by training our law enforcement more effectively to deal with it better.
Jody, the Ferguson report by the DOJ has been criticized for not really resulting in deep enough reforms. Do you think that the Baltimore report will go the same way? I mean, it's one thing for the DOJ, particularly in Obama's last year in office, to come up with this report. It's another thing for this report to actually be taken seriously.
Yeah, robust enforcement. You know, it sometimes doesn't happen. Sometimes it does. I'll give one example. LAPD is under a lot of fire now for not taking the black lives that have been lost recently through shootings seriously enough. And I share those concerns. It has a lot of problems yet to address, okay? But it's also come a long way. Thanks to a DOJ consent decree at the 1999-2000, really at the end of 99-2000, that really had teeth in it and really created a transformation in LAPD's interaction with the community. Now, that's not again to say that it has arrived, but LAPD used to be something along the lines of Serpico, LA Confidential, and Training Day all rolled together. That was the Rampart scandal with Rafael Perez finale. And the department has come a long way from those days. And so the DOJ's consent decree approach can work, but it's going to take real oversight and real enforcement and prioritizing it as an enforcement matter. Hmm.
And by the way, the occupation of LA City Hall, calling for the firing of LAPD Police Chief Charlie Beck, has continued 1 month in, and we've been bringing reports from that occupation. Jody, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Jody Armour is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California, and he is also the race and criminal justice correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Los Angeles police officers fatally shot a 14-year-old boy in the predominantly Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights on Tuesday, August 9th. Police say that the teenage boy, named Jesse Romero, shot at them as he was running away. And at least one witness corroborates the story. But another witness says they saw the boy throw a gun, which accidentally fired when it hit a fence. Romero's mother says her son did not own a gun. LAPD recovered a rusted antique gun from the scene that they say was fired by Romero. There has been tension and anger in Boyle Heights all week, with a number of vigils and protests calling for justice for Jesse Romero. Among those who've been gathering is my guest, Sol Marquez. She is a member of Centro CSO and a resident of Boyle Heights. She lives in the same neighborhood as Jesse Romero's family. Welcome to the program, Sol.
Thank you for having me.
So what, as far as you understand, is the official story of what happened? I know that the LAPD are saying they're in the middle of an investigation right now. There's body camera video that they say they're sorting through. But as far as you understand, what did they say played out on Tuesday?
Well, they're saying that they got a call from the gang violence department section of their police force. And supposedly there were two teenagers, or I guess they were reporting at first that it was some 20-year-olds who were vandalizing. I imagine they were maybe doing graffiti, but a pursuit ensued, and in the middle of that, they went through my street, which is Chicago, that's where I live, and they went a street over, and that's where they actually shot and killed the 14-year-old Jesse Romero.
And so what the very crucial fact in all of this is this issue of the gun. That's how police are justifying, and that's how they often justify shootings that apparently Jesse Romero fired at them. I mean, it seems, you know, like a death wish for anybody to fire at a police officer today. But still, of course, we don't know what happened unless we were actually there seeing it happen. But what do you make of these allegations that he fired a gun that the police found that is an antique?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're right. It is hard to believe this story. I would say as a member of Centro CSO and the history that Centro CSO has had in Boyle Heights, we have seen LAPD lie before about, you know, guns being present, about there being a stolen vehicle. With Edwin Rodriguez, this was a victim of sheriff brutality. This happened on February 14th of this year. Edwin Rodriguez was in East LA, and he was just driving through the street, and there was supposedly a stolen vehicle that he was in, and it was not stolen. At first, the sheriffs also said that he owned a gun and had a gun and had turned it on them, and now they've totally backtracked on both of those statements, saying, actually, the vehicle wasn't stolen, and there was no gun present. So, you know, from our perspective, we're here because this is not an isolated case. There have been four this year in Boyle Heights. So, you know, we're
four
here
shootings?
Four killings by LAPD.
And by the way, Central CSO, CSO is Community Service Organization. You referred to your work. Can you expand on that? And also paint a picture for our non-LA audience of what Boyle Heights is. This is a historic neighborhood. It has a very distinct identity politically, racially, et cetera.
Yes, ma'am, that's exactly correct. Boyle Heights is, we always refer to it as the heart of East LA. And throughout history, through the 50s, through the 40s, it has been very much the battle of the Chicanos people here in what we normally call Aslan. It's the area that once belonged to Mexico, and through the history has now been seeing a lot of repression for us Chicanos. Centro CSO itself is an organization that was created in 1947, and it led one of the biggest battles that occurred in 1951. It was called Bloody Christmas, where LAPD officers actually got very drunk and beat up many of the people that were incarcerated in their jail. And Centro CSO led one of those battles back then, and actually was victorious. A lot of these police officers were actually reprimanded and even went to court for the crimes that they committed against the Chicanos in the jail cells in 1951.
So let's talk about what Jesse Romero's killing means in the context, and the killings really of all four people in Boyle Heights means in this political context. The police claim that he was a member of a gang. Some media have even reported that they saw gang signs at Jesse Romero's vigil. Is this a very convenient frame through which young Latinos are criminalized and young Chicanos are criminalized?
I would definitely agree with that, Sonali. You know, it's a way to basically draw attention away from the fact that LAPD hasn't just done this once this year. This is the second time this year that they've killed a teenager claiming that he was in his late 20s. And with the first case as well, Jose Peruzzi Mendez, which happened on February 6th, he was 16, and they also claimed that he had a gun and that he was involved in gangs. I think that it's a very convenient way for them to say, hey, don't feel sorry for these victims that we just killed. Remember, they're gangsters, so nobody should feel sorry for them. When in reality, they should be saying, why is LAPD, you know, killing people that are maybe just tagging a wall? Normally in Los Angeles, we see people just get a ticket, but in these cases, they're shooting down and gunning people in plain daylight.
So tell us a little bit about the Romero family, what they've been going through, the unimaginable loss that just not only traumatizes the family, but I can imagine the entire neighborhood.
Yes, ma'am, you're correct. We had Miss Teresa Dominguez present. That's Jesse Romero's mom on Wednesday. That was the day after they actually shot Jesse Romero. And we attempted, she had at first told us that she was ready to speak. And when the time came during the rally, she couldn't find the words. She was overcome with grief. She hadn't slept in 24 hours. And, you know, I am myself not a mother. I do plan on being a mother here in Boyle Heights one day. But, you know, how terrible to know that your child could be walking down the street and just because he looks a certain way is now targeted and even gunned down for just being who he is.
And she says he did not own a gun. What do you know of Jesse himself? I understand that he attended a local school there, and, you know, he was known in the community.
Yeah, I personally did not know Jesse Romero, but there is talk that maybe he was, just dressed as what we see as a cholo, a gangster. But, you know, aside from that, I wouldn't be able to tell you that the police themselves knew that when they decided to pursue him and actually gun him down.
Right. I mean, and being in a gang, even if one is in a gang, does not warrant extrajudicial execution.
Yes, ma'am, you're correct. I completely agree.
Tell me about the vigils and the protests that have been happening in the community. There seems to be a heightening tension. Is it? Do you feel that the people are getting angrier?
Yes. You know, a lot of people have said to us as Centro CSO that they never knew that the Latino community or the Chicano community here in Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles was actually fighting back. They, you know, we are in complete solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement throughout the country, and it's a great movement. You know, Black lives are killed and gunned down, and in Chicago they're gunned down every few minutes. And so, you know, we want them to understand that this is a historical way that we have been fighting back. Maybe there isn't as much attention because a lot of the community in Boyle Heights is predominantly undocumented, but you know, Mexicanos, Centroamericanos are coming to the United States and their children are being killed at alarming rates, especially here in Boyle Heights. So,
and that's a really important point. One's legal status, one's residency, whether one has papers or not, absolutely has a bearing on how boldly one can protest and put oneself in the crosshairs, even, you know, in a more prominent way of authorities. So it sounds like people are risking that as they come out in Boyle Heights.
Yes, they have been. Many of these parents are undocumented. Many of the family members of these victims are undocumented, and yet you're seeing a lot of rallies. We're actually having another one at Centro CSO with the family, with the mother, and we just want everybody to unite around these times of tension. We do need the community to unite and not blame ourselves for the crimes that LAPD are committing against us.
So let's talk about how important it is for there to be solidarity between Black and Brown in LA. There is right now a more than month-long occupation of City Hall by Black Lives Matter. They're calling on Chief Charlie Beck to be fired. Would you and others in Boyle Heights join in that call for Charlie Beck to be fired?
Yes, Sonali. Actually, we went as a community. Centro CSO did call for an action not too long ago, and we did go to one of the general body meetings of Black Lives Matter there, right outside of City Hall. We sat down in the circle with them. We took families of police brutality from Boyle Heights there, and together we were all together uniting around the fact that we do want Chief Beck to be fired. We do want these killer cops to be tried or jailed at least for the crimes that they are committing. And Centro CSO is having an event on August 29th. It's at the Chicano Moratorium, which is an event that happened in the 60s and 70s around the police brutality and around the fact that the Vietnam War was going on, and they used a lot of the Chicanos and drafted them for those war crimes of the U.S. And we're going to be having this event. Some speakers from Black Lives Matter will also be there. And, you know, we just want everybody to know that the Chicano community, the Latino community, the Black Lives Matter community here in Los Angeles is united, and we have one common enemy, and we will be continuing our fight against these police crimes.
So much was made of the fact that LAPD officers would be outfitted with body cameras as a deterrent to police violence. But we do know in the case of Romero's killing that there is body camera evidence that the police are poring over. Do you trust this kind of evidence? I mean, would you like, for example, for the police to release it to the public immediately, even as they are examining what happened?
Yes, I mean, we do know that throughout the country, a lot of people have been calling for these cameras to be placed on these police officers. In so many cases, a lot of the cameras either malfunction or they've been turned off. If there is any video of what they did to Jesse Romero, I really, really doubt that they're even going to be releasing it to the public. In California, there are basically no cases where the body cameras on these killer cops are even used. There was a camera right above a business when we were rallying outside. We noticed it, so maybe there's camera evidence there. But there is a picture going around that basically shows the police officers on the opposite side of the fence where a witness claimed that the gun was thrown. Mm-hmm. And it's on the opposite side of Jesse Romero's body.
Now, how important is it also for us to keep reminding ourselves that the police are supposed to be trained in de-escalation, right? I mean, when there's a 14-year-old present, are people in Boyle Heights asking the question of, you know, why weren't they able to de-escalate the situation without violence? Why weren't they able to, you know, even if they had to, injure him without killing him? Why did they have to kill him?
Yes, exactly. I'm not too sure if they really are trained in de-escalating a situation. It seems like more and more they're actually trained to kill. We know that a lot of the police forces in the United States have been training Israeli forces in the occupation of Palestine. Why is it that these tactics are being used, you know, to commit these crimes when, you know, if they're being trained to de-escalate the situation, they're really more so practicing, you know, killing or militarizing a place instead of de-escalating it.
Finally, how are you calling on people to show solidarity, particularly with the Romero family? This is a very, very difficult time for them. The trauma is unimaginable. You know, the family, I understand, did give some interviews, but what is the best way to express solidarity?
Yes, they are very heartbroken about this. A lot of the family members and friends came out and, you know, they were visibly angry. They were vocally angry. What I've seen and been astounded by is that the other parents who have been victims to these police crimes have been themselves going out of their way to be in contact and to find these families. Jose Peruzzi Mendez's family, this is the 16-year-old that was killed earlier this year. His family actually, out of themselves, they found the family of Jesse Romero, and they went to their house to talk to them one-on-one and tell them, hey, you're not alone. We understand the grief that you're going through. And it's been amazing that unfortunately, through these awful situations, they've been able to band together and unite. And I do believe the best form of solidarity is if you can come out and show your support and show your anger and not jump to conclusions that you know, the LAPD might want you to believe. The best form of solidarity would be to actually physically be there and unite with us as much as possible.
And by the way, on this issue of their claims that he was possibly a member of a gang, it turns out that Jesse Romero was actually enrolled in an anti-gang program. So many of these details are still unfolding. It is a case that just happened a few days ago, and we'll certainly continue to follow it and bring up some more interviews in the coming weeks and months. Thank you so much, Sol, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having Centro CSO here. We appreciate it.
Sol Marquez is a member of Centro CSO and resident of Boyle Heights. She lives in the same neighborhood as Jesse Romero's family. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Jeremy Corbyn, the UK's popular Labour Party leader, has faced one obstacle after another from both outside and even inside his own party. The long-time staunchly leftist activist shocked many when he came into his leadership position on a strongly anti-austerity, anti-war platform, often compared to Bernie Sanders in the US. Corbyn has managed to hold on to power so far, and many in the UK are hopeful that his leadership will last longer and have more specific consequences than Sanders in the US. Joining me now is Hilary Wainwright. She's a well-known British journalist and writer, founding editor of Red Pepper, a popular left publication. She's also a fellow of the Transnational Institute and senior research associate at the International Centre for Participation Studies at the Department of Peace Studies, University of Bradford. And she's been a visiting professor at a number of international universities, including UCLA. And her essay, The Making of Jeremy Corbyn, was just published in a new anthology called Europe in Revolt. Welcome to the program, Hilary.
Hi, well, good to be here, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how did somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, somebody with his politics, actually make it to not just the top, but the very leadership of the Labour Party? That story in itself, I think, is an important one, right?
Yes, very important. And it was surprising for many of us. You know, I remember having dinner with some friends who were all, you know, all on the left, you know, and hearing that he might be on the ballot or might not. I mean, the crown in Parliament is what MPs, they give their oath to the crown in Parliament, which is really the state, rather than to the people. So it's a kind of very sacred institution. So the PLP, as it's called, the Parliamentary Labour Party, has a great sense of its own importance. And it initially was the body that decided on the leader. Now, over the years, particularly in the 70s, there's been a revolt against this, and the franchise has been widened, firstly to include the unions, then to include the membership. But still, the Parliamentary Party had considerable power. And when Jeremy began his, as it were, journey, the campaign to be leader, it was a matter, it had got back to simply the MPs had 15% sort of role. I mean, they had, all candidates had to get 15% of the PLP nominating them. So it was a bit, I mean, that's not a huge amount, it was about 35 MPs, but it was a bit touch and go whether he would get those nominations. So that was the first hurdle. And it's first maybe important to know that the left had been pretty much defeated inside the party, particularly inside the Parliamentary Party, by Tony Blair and New Labour. So standing from the left in the leadership election was a pretty unrewarding process. And, you know, the left MPs sat round a table, only about four of them, and thought, well, we better, somebody needs to stand. Everybody's asking us for a voice for the left. And John McDonnell, who's now shadow chancellor, in effect, you know, one of Jeremy's allies, said, well, I did it last year and I've had a heart attack and I can't do it again. And Diane Abbott, who was, you know, a very feisty black MP, very, very good campaigning MP, had done it once before. And she said, well, I never get anywhere. I can't do it. And they all looked at Jeremy, and he's a very kind of very nice guy. And he said, OK, well, I guess it's my turn. But he was no way like sort of thrusting, wanting to do it. He was a reluctant candidate. In a way, that's kind of maybe a good thing, because people are wanting a different kind of leadership. They're completely fed up. When I say they, I mean a mass of people. The polls indicate very widespread disillusion. It's indicated also in the numbers of abstentions. People are really disillusioned with the political class. And Jeremy is, in a sense, maybe like Bernie Sanders, a kind of anti-politics politician. He's highly political, but in a way he made his oath to the people. Well, in fact, he made it, obviously, like all MPs, to the crown, probably with his fingers crossed. But, you know, he day-to-day makes an oath to the people in his practice. He's always giving voice, championing different struggles. So anyway, once he got on, just very quickly to do the explanation, once he got onto the ballot, he was like a sort of lightning rod for all this disillusionment and the sort of pent-up anger built up since Thatcher destroyed industry, destroyed the unions. And then there'd been a rule change which enabled individual members of unions to vote rather than it being done through a bloc, which was in the power of the leadership. And again, that gave a voice to the angry rank and file. And so in a way, it became a completely unexpected campaign. You know, young people were climbing into the windows of his meetings. It just gathered momentum. And so he won. But it was on the basis of this sort of wave of discontent, of indignation, as people say, that is evident in different forms in different countries. You know, it's evident in the squares of Spain, in the squares of Greece, in the primary elections in the United States. And in Britain, it's been expressed through the Labour Party.
And just to clarify, yes, just to clarify also to our American audience, Jeremy Corbyn essentially won the leadership of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party has a similar reputation to the Democratic Party in the US, where it has stated values of populism, of liberalism, and however, in the end, ends up being in the service of business interests, corporate interests, and being pro-austerity. And so the left, internal left wing of the Labour Party, like the internal left wing of the Democratic Party, has been trying for years to actually have those values come in line with policies. Now, what sort of opposition has Jeremy Corbyn faced, not just from outside the party, but even from inside the party?
Well, I think that goes back to the point I was making about the Parliamentary Labour Party, because that's where the opposition is coming from. I mean, his support is amongst members and amongst supporters of the Labour Party, some of whom aren't members, but who support it. So it's a bit like, was a bit like a primary. But you know, the Parliamentary Party, they feel they have the prerogative, a bit like managers, you know, standby managerial prerogative. The PLP cannot believe that their prerogative to decide the leader, to decide the future of the party, to really be in charge, you know, could be challenged. So they, from the beginning, combined with the New Labour hatred of the left, you know, in a way, it's a bit like a somebody trying to get rid of rats in their house. The New Labour people were trying to, as it were, hired rent a kill or employed their own tactics to get rid of the left, and then, as it were, a rat kind of starts actually dominating the house, you know, and that's unbelievable. So they were like, it was like a nightmare to them. So after Jeremy won, there was, in a sense, a set determination to catch him out, to get rid of him. So he faced opposition right from the beginning. He was never really given a fair chance. I mean, which is, it's ironic, because the unity has been such an important theme in the Labour Party. You know, it's almost transferred from the industrial context, where a strike, unity is all. Similarly, in the Labour Party, you know, the left often abandoned its protests in the build-up to an election in order to be united in facing the Tories. The right and the people opposing Jeremy, the leadership of the Parliamentary Labour Party, had no compunction but to oppose him. And then finally, after the vote in the European, the referendum around Europe, after that vote went against Remain, which was the Labour Party's position, and Jeremy's position was...
This is on the Brexit vote.
Sorry?
This is on the Brexit vote, yeah.
The Brexit vote, yes. So then they really turned on him and blamed him for that. And then they started resigning and put pressures on others to resign. So now he's got a group of about 40 MPs. He's rebuilt the shadow cabinet, but he's got the huge majority of members, you know, who, after all, in the end, the Labour Party depends on members to win elections, to campaign, to canvass, to bring people to vote, to persuade people to vote. So, I mean, you can't become an MP without the members. So, but the Parliamentary Party is sort of blind somehow to the members.
And so, of course, many within the party who would like to keep the status quo would, you know, are not happy with his energizing of the Labour Party's base, I understand. There's been some bizarre allegations about racism and anti-Semitism. But Jeremy Corbyn, who's on the left, who's had very strong positions of being anti-war, of being pro-refugee, what do these, you know, where do these allegations come from, and are the public buying it?
I don't think the public are buying it. I mean, the polls are not good for Labour, but my analysis is that they're not good. You know, they've fallen well behind the Conservatives, but that's because people vote against a disunited party. So it's the disunity that has caused the low popularity, not all these accusations or, you know, disillusionment with Jeremy. I mean, the anti-Semitism thing began with some unfortunate remark by Ken Livingstone about the Jews. I mean, it wasn't anti-Semitic, but it wasn't well chosen. And Jeremy, you know, ticked him off, and he's now been expelled from the party. But and no way is Jeremy anti-Semitic. And there's been a commission which has definitely cleared him and cleared the Labour Party. I mean, there's a sort of an element of Israel and sort of Zionists using Jeremy's pro-Palestinian politics to kind of build up an accusation of anti-Semitism.
Right, we're very familiar here in the US as well. So, so let's talk about the impact of Corbyn's leadership, broadly speaking. In your essay in the book Europe in Revolt, you begin by comparing him to Alexis Tsipras, the Greek prime minister who just a year ago energized and excited many the world over. And then we saw, of course, sadly, how the Syriza party that he helped to found, what direction it went in. Into here in the U.S. Many Bernie Sanders supporters have been hugely disappointed. Do those cases, are they a warning for Corbyn and also a warning for the left, broadly speaking, that getting involved in electoral politics to try to use electoral politics to make change from the inside can be extremely difficult and possibly impossible?
Yes, I think that certainly lessons have to be learned. I mean, I think my comparison was a little bit around the fact, although you talk about Jeremy being in power, in fact, like Tsipras, who wasn't in power, he was in office in the Greek state. You know, the power lay with the European Union and the IMF. And similarly, Jeremy is in office in the leadership office in the Labour Party, but he's not in power. He doesn't have power over the Labour Party. That's still in the hands of the parliamentary party and the old apparatus. So he does face a problem. And I think the lesson from Greece is that in a way, the Syriza leadership, who haven't lost their sort of radical intentions, but strategically they put too much faith in the European Union. They really thought the European Union would take seriously the electoral mandate they had when they came to office. But as Varoufakis has made very clear, Schäuble, you know, the German Chancellor, and probably other EU negotiators, for them, you know, elections were up, and I think Schäuble absolutely said it, electoral considerations do not overcome economics. So economics is all, you know, and maintaining a market economy, maintaining a capitalist economy, meeting the deficit requirements and so on. All those are the prime sort of objectives of the EU, and democracy really is a very low priority. And so that was Tsipras's problem. And, you know, some people say that he should have done more to build on Syriza's relationship with social movements, particularly the solidarity initiatives that were like trying to build an alternative economy. And in a way, I mean, I agree with that. I think it's necessary if you are going, you need to be in and against the state and in and against the market. So you need to engage, but you need to be always building autonomous sources of power. So it's never either or. For me, it's never either electoral or social movement. You need both. I mean, social movements in all these countries have in the end sought some electoral expression because they need, you know, they need regimes of austerity to end. They need legislation condoning evictions to end. They need political action, but they need their own sources of power. They can't rely on the state to do their bidding. So those MPs, those parliamentary representatives need to be backed, not just by protest movements, but by real economic initiatives and sources of counterpower.
And then so finally, Hillary, does Corbyn and the left wing of the Labour Party have that social base in the public?
I think it's building it. I mean, they've created this movement, momentum, to try and consolidate the support that he had outside the party and amongst new party members. And that movement, I mean, I've got, there's one in Hackney where I live. And we, you know, we put as much of our time into supporting doctors fighting privatisation and cuts in the health service, teachers fighting privatisation of the health service, tenants fighting the selling off of council housing. We bring them to our meetings, discuss how we can help them. And we build as much support for them as we do put energy into changing the Labour Party. So it's got to be that sort of dual strategy.
Well, Hillary Wainwright, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Well, thanks, Sonali. I've enjoyed your questions.
Hillary Wainwright is a well-known British journalist and writer. She's a founding editor of Red Pepper, a popular left publication. And we've been talking about her essay, The Making of Jeremy Corbyn, that was just published in a new anthology called Europe in Revolt. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
It is 7 p.m. and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO every second Friday from 8 to 10 p.m. for 1212.